I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Robert S. Taylor, professor of political science at UC Davis. We're discussing his 2017 book, Exit Left, Markets and Mobility in Republican Thought, from Oxford University Press. Taylor works on contemporary analytic political philosophy and the thought of Immanuel Kant. His first book, Reconstructing Roles, The Kantian Foundations of Justice as Fairness, was published in 2011. Let me say, first of all, Bob, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeff.
So, Bob, this is a great book. I loved reading it. Really important contribution to Republican theory, particularly by way of the way that you apply the principles of Republicanism, that you show that these principles need not be applied in a political way, but rather can be economic in nature as well. And it was a really helpful reminder that theoretical principles that we work with in the institutional and policy implications of those principles are distinct things, and that there can be distinct applications of any set of principles. So let me say, first of all, thanks so much for the book.
Thanks for reading it and having me on to talk about it.
Yeah. So first of all, I usually ask, Bob, what motivated you to write this book? Why did you take up republicanism as a theory, and why adopt this market-based approach?
Sure. Well, I guess the jumping off point for it is sort of, it was a little odd. And in fact, I'm not even sure I mentioned it in the book itself, but I was reading, Annie Stiltz's book, Liberal Loyalty, and it draws heavily on republicanism, the republican tradition, especially Kant. And there's a passage in the book where she's talking about, she's going through an elaborate example of, I believe, a single mother who's in a state of vulnerability specifically of a Republican kind that is vulnerable to domination and to exercises of arbitrary power over her. And one of the contexts she puts this vulnerable single mother in is that of her relationship with her landlord, and the idea that the landlord can at any time terminate the rental agreement, etc. And therefore the landlord themselves, him or herself, is in a position of a dominating position over the single mother. And it struck me as a under theorized claim. There wasn't enough context for me to assess whether this was true or not, because you can imagine rental markets, say like a rental market where, the occupancy rate's only 20% or something, right? So you have a massive number of surplus apartments. I would suggest in that case that it's more likely that the renters are in a position to dominate landlords as opposed to vice versa, right? The landlord says, do X, do Y. I can always say, well, to hell with you. I'll just go to another landlord. I'll find another apartment. Of course, many are available. So what sort of struck me about it was that this claim of domination, this relationship, really should have been made contingent upon certain features of the market, structural features of the rental market, but wasn't. And then that led me to ask the question, well, if I go to other Republican works, if I go to Pettit's Republicanism, if I go to Frank Lovett's General Theory, if I go to Dagger's work, if I go to the work of all these neo-Republicans, and I look and see what they say about the role that market structure plays in domination, what will I find? And I found that there wasn't really a whole lot of discussion of this issue. And that led to led me to think that maybe there needs to be more work done on what generally you could call the economic side of republicanism, or what I term commercial republicanism, which itself has a long history. Whereas, as you noted earlier, I think most of the responses to the problem of arbitrary power in relationships has been with political solutions, or what I call political solutions in the text. And those would include sort of standard constitutional and participatory approaches to the problem of arbitrary power, constitutional approaches like the separation of powers or federalism as a way of constraining state power, and participatory approaches like direct democratic participation through elections, through contestation, etc. That people didn't really talk much about the use of economic means to deal with these issues, the possibility of exiting relationships that are dominating in some way, and what the state can do to resource that kind of exit and to make the, you know, the context within those within which those relationships are embedded more competitive.
Yeah, that's great. I think you do that quite well. I mean, to bring out this alternative side of republicanism that really is a plausible way to apply the principles. So that's great. So let's start with the general principles of republicanism before applying them to the in an economic way, in the way you want to do. So to get at republicanism, maybe let's focus on the problem that animates republican thinking, which is, as you say in the introduction, the problem of arbitrary power, which is what republicanism seeks to free us from. The notion of freedom as non-domination is freedom from this arbitrary power. And so let me just quote from the first page. You say arbitrary power is a pervasive feature in human societies. Women suffer in silence at the hands of domineering husbands who inflict psychological and physical abuse at will, unchecked by effective laws or cultural norms. Workers without meaningful options in life toil under the capricious rule of foremen, afraid to speak out against mistreatment for the fear of losing their jobs. Residents of inner-city minority communities endure the daily humiliation of stop and frisk by police engaged in racial profiling, and so forth. I mean, there are many examples that more examples that we could point to. You point out that arbitrary power is bad because it leads to exploitation, but also has this effect on character, that it's corrupting of character and morally stifling of our character in general. So maybe let's just start off. What is arbitrary power?
Right. And I tend to use just a kind of off-the-shelf definition from Pettit. So an early paper of his, freedom as anti-power. And he has elaborated upon this in later works and made small modifications to it. But I think the basic definition is a good one. So he says that, one agent dominates or possesses arbitrary power over another when she has, quote, the capacity to interfere with impunity and at will in certain choices that the other is in a position to make, especially I think when those choices are especially important choices or fundamental choices that people have about marriage, about work, about residency, and so forth. And for me, I think the key terms here sort of go through is, first, there's the capacity to interfere. It's not actual interference, I think, that is the central concern of republicanism, but rather the capacity to interfere, the ability to interfere, right? And the reason I emphasize that is there are certain kinds of relationships you can imagine, let's say some kind of ideal master-slave relationship where a master has not just arbitrary power, but complete arbitrary power over a slave, and yet the master is completely benevolent, perfectly benevolent, right? Under those circumstances, we would still say the slave is dominated, and we would say the slave is dominated because of the capacity, because they still rely upon the continuing goodwill of the master. And that's what Republicans mean by the idea of vulnerability. We are vulnerable to the exercise of arbitrary power, this kind of interference with impunity and at will over us, even if at any particular moment, or because of a particular master that we have, that interference is unlikely to take place. We are likely to be left alone. So I'd emphasize the capacity side of it. Also, the impunity and at will parts. I mean, the idea of interfering with at will is fairly straightforward, that it's simply a matter of the choice or whim of the interferer. With impunity, again, the idea that there's no active punishment or countering of that kind of interference. And so most Republican thinkers are trying to come up with ways that this kind of domination, this capacity for arbitrary interference, can be countered in various ways. And there are political approaches, again, like participation, like constitutional constraints. And then there are the kind of economic approaches that I talk about in the book, namely empowering people to exit relationships that have those qualities of domination.
Yeah, when you talk about arbitrary power near the beginning in the introduction of the book, certainly, and this is the way Pettit talks about it, it strikes me that there are really, two different features of it, in this sense that, arbitrary power is opposed to power that's bounded by law, right, or some general principle.
Sure.
right? So that's the idea of, you know, arbitrariness is the ability to act according to one's whim. But then the other feature of it is power that doesn't track one's interest, which I found that interesting in thinking about Pettit's work. Because in one sense, as you suggest, you could think of a kind of benevolent despot who's able to track the interests of the person, the people who he's in power over better than maybe they themselves can. So that's still an example of arbitrary power on your view. It's someone who does not act according to law, but it's someone who tracks the interest.
Right. I think neo-Republican theorists differ somewhat on these issues. So, for instance, Pettit and Lovett have a different view. In fact, Lovett accuses Pettit, in terms of his definition, of having a kind of moralized conception of domination, a moralized conception of freedom, in the sense that Pettit says, look, it's not just procedural arbitrariness that matters. It's also the question of whether the person who's interfering is tracking the interests of the interferee. And Lovett prefers a more stripped down definition that's purely procedural in nature. Just ask questions about whether there's some sort of arbitrariness in the interference without asking the question about tracking. But I think Pettit's definition, by including tracking, I think fits in general better with a lot of intuitions that we have, maybe avoids some problems with Lovett's version. I mean, one of those intuitions is that we don't think that when power is exercised over us, it's necessarily problematic, even if it may have some discretionary elements, if we feel that the person, we have some kind of guarantee that the person who's exercising it is in fact tracking our interest, and that tracking is maybe being generated by certain kinds of, say, constitutional participatory constraints. Our ability, for instance, to remove the person from power if they are behaving in a way that doesn't track our interests, or maybe constitutional constraints in the form of judicial review, say, to constrain that exercise of power. The problem with making, I think, the idea of arbitrary interference or definition of domination as purely procedural in nature is that sometimes the non-moralized version can be, well, it can allow for certain forms of ugliness. For instance, it may very well have been the case that the Nuremberg laws were not procedurally arbitrary. But what we can say about the Nuremberg laws is that they in no way track the interests of those who are being interfered with. And so the problem, Lovett recognizes this problem. Lovett suggests, well, maybe there's just a properly stripped down version of domination. We'll have to suggest the problem with the Nuremberg laws was not a problem of arbitrary power, some other kind of problem, a problem with distributive justice, let's say. But I think that the moralized definition, to use Lovett's language here, the moralized definition that Pettit gives us tracks certain considered convictions we have about domination. When we look at something like the Nuremberg laws, what we want to say is that we have one group dominating another group, namely Jews in this case, and his version can capture it, whereas a more stripped down version, I think, has difficulties capturing that intuition.
Yeah, well, it strikes me that your particular interest and exit seems to match well better with the tracking interests side of Pettit's view, right? So one of the things that you emphasize throughout is that one of the things that exit does is that it encourages the interest of, say, management and employees to be aligned, right? Rather than that, whereas the political approaches, say, the regulatory constitutional approaches seem to place more emphasis on the rule of law. But maybe that's making too much of that distinction.
No, I don't think so. I think the tracking interest element of the Pettit definition does fit well with what I'm after. And partly it's the result of certain kinds of, results from welfare economics, which is the first welfare theorem, saying that basically competitive equilibria can be efficient in a certain way, that is Pareto-optimal, at least under certain kinds of conditions. And throughout this text, whether I'm talking about marriage markets or spousal markets or dating markets, whether I'm talking about labor markets and product markets, or whether I'm talking about residential markets, the ability to leave one political subunit and enter into another, in all those cases, I'm often relying upon the role that competitive markets can play. And if those competitive markets are truly competitive, that is, people have been properly, their exits been properly resourced, and they have many suppliers, partner providers from whom to choose, if those conditions hold, then a certain kind of efficiency, at least in principle, can be achieved. And that can be understood as tracking the interests of participants. As much as they may disagree about how the pie is shared, they all have an interest in making the pie as large as possible, making economic welfare as large as possible. And so again, this kind of, it's explicit in the text, but also at times implicit in the text, this focus on welfare, including one's interest in not being dominated, it fits well. I think it fits well with that, you know, substantive element to Pettit's definition of domination, or as Lovett puts it, the moralized definition.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so the question for republicanism then is how to address and reduce this arbitrary power. And you talk about two different options that Republicans have, with a nod to Albert Hirschman's work, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. That is, that Republicans have tended to emphasize voice as the way to reduce or address arbitrary power, and have overlooked the role that exit can play in addressing arbitrary power. So I thought maybe we could talk about voice first. And it turns out, as we've been saying, that most Republican theorists have overwhelmingly looked to voice to reduce arbitrary power. So why have they looked to voice, and what are the main types of voice that they advocate?
Right. I think this is going to overlap substantially with the sort of the voice exit distinction will end up to some extent overlapping with the political economic distinction I was making earlier. But I think that for the most part, the emphasis on voice has been due to the fact that the focus of Republicans historically, whether we're talking about, especially in the neo-Roman Republican tradition, we're talking about Cicero, Machiavelli, talking about Madison, the dominating agent that has been the subject of their studies has overwhelmingly been the state. And so the focus has been on how do you constrain the state and make sure the state itself is not a dominating force within the societies that it governs. And insofar as that's the focus, especially if you're talking about a centralized state, or let's say the federal state within a federal system, then exit's not going to be a very powerful checking force, you might say, against the exercise of arbitrary power. The reason being that exit costs are so high. What are you going to do if you have a tyrant that's abusing you? Leaving the society, exiting the society, is often going to be very costly, or at least costly for people who are not well-heeled, costly if you're not, you know, a transnational corporation. And for that reason, I think Republicans, and rightly so, have focused on voice as a potential response to domination by political actors, and voice, again, in a number of different ways, right, including in the sort of constitutional and participatory ways I've talked about. Participatory in the sense of, you know, using elections, using contestation, which might occur in the streets through protests, potentially even revolution, maybe through media, through pressure groups, etc., and also constitutional means, separation of powers, federalism itself as a way for different levels of government to check each other. All of these are forms, what I take it to be, forms of voice, ways that people can speak out and have their voice registered and responded to. And so exit, I think, as a consequence, has played a relatively limited role. And I think, you know, and again, at one point in the book, I do talk about how we can apply exit even in political circumstances, although, again, that's going to be most effective, say, for local forms of government that are relatively cheap to exit, right? Say, within a federal system, to move from one city to another city, from one state to another state, not as effective at the national level. But what I think is unfortunate is that because of this past emphasis on limiting the power, the arbitrary power of the state, that when Republicans have confronted domination in other contexts, so confronted domination within the family or confronted domination in the workplace, they've tended to just, I don't want to say blindly, but by a sort of false analogy, they've said, well, voice has to be the answer in those cases as well. So in the case of the workplace, for instance, they've tended to push for voice-oriented solutions to problems of domination, let's say in monopsonistic or oligopsonistic labor markets where there's only one or a few employers in a particular industry. So workers don't have a lot of choices and are subject to arbitrary power at employers. What can you do in those cases? And Republicans have typically said, well, we need voice solutions of various kinds. They could be constitutional in structure. So, for instance, you could have the government as a kind of regulatory agent, countering the power of businesses, kind of being a countervailing force, so to speak. You could also have participatory solutions, so allowing workers a voice in managerial decisions, or maybe even going as far as something like associational socialism, where workers themselves control the factory. Every workforce becomes a little demos, so to speak. And that's typically the way they've responded. But I think as you go down in these hierarchies, as you go to workplaces, as you go to the family, exit costs are much lower there, and it's not clear that a voice-oriented approach is always the best approach in those circumstances. Maybe an exit-oriented approach is best. And as I said, that may even apply in cases where the political units, for instance, are more like firms providing services. And that's one way you can think about cities, is they provide a variety of public services, and they're relatively cheap to exit, to move from one city to another city. In that case, again, exit might be a genuine option for limiting arbitrary power.
Yeah, that's good. And we'll take up those particular examples that you have in chapters 2, 3, and 4 in a second. I wanted to ask in general what the problem is, the limitations of voice as a solution. You appeal to, you know, public choice economics and the kind of theoretical problems that they identify with some of these solutions. So what are the limitations of that approach?
Right. I think, well, from a Republican point of view, I think one of the dangers of voice is that by empowering particular actors to counter, let's say, private exercises of power, you know, empowering, say, regulators in the federal government to limit exercises of power in the workplace of employers, say, over employees, or providing that kind of power to limit private domination, let's say, within the household, for instance, for an abused wife and an abusive husband in that kind of situation. I think one of the dangers there is that by countering one kind of power with another kind of power, the power that's doing the countering itself will have discretionary features and inevitably will have discretionary features. So take something like a regulator who's been tasked, say by Congress, say there's some kind of law that creates a regulatory agency, to deal with problems of domination in the workplace. Well, that agency itself will have to promulgate regulations. Those regulations will have to be interpreted in particular contexts. They will have to be enforced also in those contexts. And invariably, there will be discretion involved, a kind of administrative discretion involved. How should we interpret this law? How should we interpret the regulation? Do we enforce it in this particular case, or do we not enforce it, or how do we go about enforcing it? And that kind of discretionary power is, if you understand the definition of domination that I provided earlier, it itself is a kind of arbitrary power. And so one of the dangers, I think, of using voice as a way to counter, let's say, especially private domination, is it counters that private domination with a kind of public domination, or a private power with a kind of public power. And in some cases, that might improve things, but in other cases, it might make the situation worse. It might simply replace one kind of power with another kind of power. And that, I think, is one of the big dangers in the use of what I call the direct empowerment of voice, is it will simply increase the total amount of domination that exists, just replacing public power with private power. And even if that's not the case, even if it's the case that by exercising that kind of public power, you'll actually reduce overall domination, the problem is you'll also be introducing this element of discretion that you wouldn't have to introduce if you use an alternative approach, namely the exit approach. And through exit, through resourced exit and enhanced competition, you can do things to limit private power without simultaneously introducing elements of public power that may reduce the effectiveness of your intervention.
Yeah, that's good. And so is your view, I was trying to figure this out as I was reading it, is your view that voice is important but not a panacea? Or is your view more critical that it is that we have to be really, really cautious about voice? And perhaps it depends on the domain or the sphere that you're talking about. When you talk about the state a little bit later, you say voice is really the only thing that works at the national level. It's a high cost to say that you can exit your particular country.
Right.
So how to characterize your general view towards voice? That it's important, but not a panacea, or we have to really be cautious about it?
Yeah, maybe something in between those two. So definitely, I do not want to commit the error of offering up exit as itself a kind of panacea, right? As you said, at the national level, it's pretty hard to make exit work. I mean, at the national level, in some cases, exit can act as a kind of complement to voice. I think in particular here of the East German situation or historical event where attempts to exit East Germany in some sense may have complemented efforts within the country through protests, et cetera, to bring down the communist regime. But I feel like in those cases, it will almost always be complementary rather than a straightforward substitute. So certainly I don't want to offer up exit as a kind of panacea. At the same time, though, I'm presenting in some sense a fairly pro-exit text, hence the title, right? And I really think that people underestimate the degree to which exit can play an important role, even in political circumstances. And that's precisely because of the possibility of exit from smaller or lower level subunits. And the way that if you've got the right kind of constitutional framework in place and you resource that exit geographically, that basically you can get local governments behaving like firms in competition with each other trying to maximize profits, except in this case, there's a different objective function. But I think even in those cases, it can play a role. And what I'm really pushing, and I guess maybe in some sense, one of the strategies or rhetorical strategies of the book is to point out to people, look, when it comes to the family situation, when it comes to, say, the relationships between men and women in a household, in a family, it's very hard to imagine what a voice-oriented approach would look like there without serious violations of privacy, without all kinds of dangers that, connubial regulators might threaten, the couple with a kind of domination even worse than the domination that currently exists within the family. What I'm trying to suggest is once you recognize that danger in the context of the family, you can also see that danger in the context of the workplace. Now, privacy considerations may be somewhat less important there, but there really is the danger of regulators themselves becoming sources of arbitrary power. And the best way to approach that problem, given the variety of workplaces, the huge number of employers and employees, is to promote competition in labor markets. As long as workers issue credible threats to leave in cases in which they're abused, then you don't need to move to solutions like worker participation and managerial decisions, much less something like associational socialism.
Yeah, good. So let's talk a little bit more about exit. It's important, I guess, to emphasize that when you're talking about exit, it struck me in large part, exit works by not necessarily exiting per se, but through the threat of exit, right? That actors are affected by exit insofar as they are aware that the people who work under them or the people who they share a family with, they can exit, right? So this leads to the importance, in your view, that exit, in order to uphold that threat, it needs to be resourced. There has to be a reasonable chance that individuals can leave wives can leave an abusive relationship, or workers are able to leave a job. Because in some sense, this is the possibility of an exit or the emphasis on exit is a fairly standard libertarian or right-leaning approach. But what's distinctive about your view is that you recognize that exit itself needs to come with certain resources that can be that need to be provided by the state.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, often when I've talked about, say, like the political side of this, like the use of exit to limit the power of the state, especially local states, and people will respond, well, that sounds a lot like the work of Nozick, you know, in the utopia part of Anarchy State Utopia, or Kukuthis, you know, the liberal archipelago. And one of the things I try to emphasize is that for Nozick and for Kukuthis and other libertarians, their interest seems to be in the idea of freedom is non-interference, avoiding certain forms of coercion. Whereas what I'm focused on is, I guess, freedom is non-domination, and choice and empowered choice is a way of confronting it. And empowering choice is not going to occur through, I think, you know, libertarian solutions. Now, whether, you know, something like a classical liberal or something more like a classical liberal solution might be the best approach, I'm open to that as a possibility, but it strikes me as very unlikely that a libertarian approach is going to be the best way. And that's precisely because choice needs to be empowered for it to be effective. I did want to say one other thing that I think it was very important about what you brought up, and that is that one of the concerns that some people express, especially more communitarian Republicans who, you know, read this text and have talked to me about it. I'm thinking of Richard Dagger here in particular. One of the things they worry about in an exit-oriented approach is that it may lead to a kind of atomism. It may lead to a society that's so fluid and so individualistic that you can't really effectively build communities or relationships with them, whether they be political relationships, economic relationships, marital relationships. And the point you made about the threat of exit, even if it's only an implicit threat of exit being a key thing, I think is a super important point. One could imagine a society where exit has been thoroughly empowered in the way that I advocate, and yet the actual amount of exit that takes place changes little or not at all. And so there's relatively little change in the fluidity or how atomized the society is, precisely because people who exercise arbitrary power see there will be cost to the exercise of that power, and therefore their hand is stayed, right? They realize if I do these things, people will exit the relationships I'm in, therefore I have to control myself and limit my behavior in some way. So in some sense, to use game theory language, exit will be off the equilibrium path, right? And you may find that actually by empowering people and empowering vulnerable people in these relationships, whether they're economic relationships, familial relationships, what have you, may not change the actual amount of exit that takes place that much, but what it will change is the nature of those relationships, right? What the relationships look like from the inside. And that, of course, is the thing that's important from a Republican point of view.
Yeah, and I wonder about that response. I was wondering about precisely this criticism of your view, the atomism criticism. And I can imagine someone like Dagger coming back and saying something like, okay, so the threat of exit may allow communities to stay together, but I suppose one might wonder about the character of that kind of community, right? So if each member of that community has one foot out the door, as it were, right? that everyone is constantly has a card in his hand, his or her hand, saying I can exit. You know, it's a kind of psychological claim, or maybe perhaps sociological claim that. How strong can those bonds be when threat is on the table?
Right. Even if it's only implied, even if only both parties understand that it's part of the structure within which they're embedded in some sense, whatever kind of market that might be. Yeah, no, I take that point. And I think it's a criticism just, you know, in some sense, I'm advocating a kind of what I would term a liberal Republican theory like that of Pettit and Lovett. And the same kinds of criticism are often made of liberalism itself, is that, yeah, sure, you can build community of various kinds within liberal societies or within a liberal Republican society, but those communities and their character will change precisely because of the rights that are defended within liberal societies or the resources that are provided within liberal societies. And in the case that I'm talking about, these rights and resources have to do with the competitiveness of various kinds of markets and the kinds of resources one can draw upon and exit. And I don't think there's any question that it will change the nature of those relationships to some degree. I guess I don't believe that it's going to, you know, end the relationships or lead to greater atomism, but there's no question that the relationship, let's say, between, you know, a husband and a wife will just look different and feel different and operate in a different way when both parties, including the more vulnerable party, which historically has been the wife, are really in a position to walk away. It will change, I think, the internal culture of marriages in an important way when husbands realize that wives have this option, even if the threat is never uttered, is never stated in any kind of explicit way. And sure, I think an egalitarian marriage culture or more egalitarian marriage culture will look different, have different norms, advance different values than a marital culture that lacks those elements. And again, I think this is also true of any kinds of relationships or communities within liberal societies. Also, when you defend individual rights, the communities that those individuals then constitute and create, the associations they create, are going to look different and have a different quality and ultimately advance different values. Now, as somebody who's sympathetic to liberalism and sympathetic to liberal republicanism, I guess I don't view that as a problem in the sense that the kinds of communities and associations that the protection of those rights, the provision of those resources will make impossible are communities and associations that shouldn't exist to begin with. You know, for instance, the patriarchal marriage. I mean, I don't want to deny that patriarchal marriages might have certain kinds of virtues associated with them. So just to give an example, if you have a system of patriarchal marriages, there's a kind of virtue that could be exercised by a husband in that situation, namely tolerance or forbearance, for instance. And, you know, in a situation where a woman can pick up and leave the marriage, and not in a way that's costless necessarily, but in a relatively low cost way, because the husband doesn't have this kind of arbitrary power, there's not really an opportunity for them to develop and exercise the virtue of forbearance in quite the same way as there was before. Now, is that a loss to the world? I guess in some strict sense, it certainly is, but I think we'd be better off having a world where it wasn't necessary for people to develop and exercise those kinds of virtues, even if we can recognize them as in some sense being valuable and something that's lost to the world when these kinds of patriarchal relationships are eliminated.
Yeah, so this might point towards something like a trade-off between different kinds of republican approaches, because let me try this on you. So what I'm thinking here is maybe a third option for Republicans. So there's exit and voice that we've talked about so far, but it strikes me that there's another option that one might think about, which is something like the use of moral norms to address arbitrary power, right? And so you could think about figures on both the right and the left in the history of political theory. So you might think about Burke, who, right, in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, talks about, you know, asks the question, what keeps a king from becoming a tyrant? It's this chivalric code of honor that keeps him from becoming a tyrant. In families, right, how to ensure men don't abuse women? Well, appeal to some kind of moral tradition or make sure some kind of moral tradition is in place. Or you might think on the left, somebody like Rousseau, that there is a great emphasis placed on the education of civic virtue, either in the form of civic religion or a form of nationalism. In fact, I think you point to on page, where is 44, about how moral constraints are the only option for family dependents, for minor children and the elderly.
Right.
As a way to address these kind of arbitrary power. Or we may think, I think most apropos of this kind of discussion about atomism and morality, you may think about patriotism too. That is, that one way to maintain a kind of commitment to the laws of one's country is to cultivate a certain patriotic attitude. So I just wonder, I mean, I wonder in general, first of all, what you think about that type of a approach for, is that something viable or maybe not something that would be advisable for Republicans to go down? And then I guess second, you know, how this connects up with this atomism worry. I mean, is something like, do you think that this kind of approach could be compatible with your exit based approach, or does it stand in some kind of tension?
Oh, no, I think it's compatible. In fact, in some sense, I think the approaches are codependent, this sort of norm approach that you're talking about. In fact, I think you can think of the approach I'm offering as being one kind or one species of norm approach. So I'm so reliant upon competitive markets and across all these spheres that I talk about in the text, whether it's the family, whether it's the workplace, whether it's the political community. And those markets, have as their chief parameter prices of various kinds. And those prices, I mean, competitive prices are just one kind of norm, right? I mean, here's where I'll link things up. Those norms, the norm of a competitive price, is itself the product of a set of rules that are enforced. Property law, contract law, torts, etc., right? And I would say the same thing about these other kinds of norms, non-price norms that emerge, but are extremely important, right? So norms of how spouses treat other spouses within marriage. Those norms are extremely important. Like, you'd even think of it in terms of, like, say, forms of address, respectful forms of address. There may be norms with respect to that. But the question I would always ask is, what kinds of contexts are those norms emerging within? And I think the quality of those norms and whether those norms are in fact norms that defend freedom as non-domination or rather undermine it is in part a function of the legal context within which it's embedded. My guess is that norms within patriarchal marriages, even insofar as they constrain, say, husbands, are going to look very different from norms within more egalitarian marriages. And one of the ways you can guarantee that marriages are more egalitarian rather than patriarchal is precisely through things like no-fault divorce, through the provision of shelters for women who are fleeing from abusive husbands, job retraining for those women, etc. So I think norms do play an important role, and prices are not the only kinds of norms that are important. But I think it's also the case that making sure those norms have the right form and play the role that we intend for them depends upon us getting other features of the institutional context right. And that's in some sense what I'm trying to do by sort of promoting the kinds of policy innovations that can make exit effective. I'll give one more example because it comes up sometimes in sort of debates within Republicanism itself about the degree to which exit can actually be useful in a workplace environment. People often point out, Alex Gurevich is one person who points this up, is that often in workplace environments, you have incomplete contracts. Contracts do not specify down to the order and the time of day, et cetera, what a boss may or may not order a employee to do. So there's a kind of arbitrariness built in or discretion built in to any labor contract, no matter how well specified it is. And this is where Alex worries about the possibility of, arbitrary power creeping its way in. And, he thinks, well, even if they're embedded within competitive labor markets, if you move from one job to another, you'll just be moving in some sense from one incomplete contract to another incomplete contract. So you'll never be able to avoid the arbitrary power of bosses or capitalists anytime there's a kind of labor relationship. And I think there's some truth to that. The problem is that I don't think he takes enough account of the fact that it's not just the labor market context and the competitiveness of that context that stays the hand of potentially abusive employers. The fact that a worker can say, you keep giving me orders like the one that you've given me, I'm going to leave and go to another employer. It's also the fact that the kind of power that workers may have in that relationship, thanks to resourced exit, can also influence the norms that govern workplaces. The idea that some things are just not done or some orders are not given, even if it's not something that's specified in a labor contract precisely because of its necessary incompleteness. And if you think about, I think, labor markets in general and employment in general, it's not just that there's, basically there's arbitrary power on the part of a boss, but with the full knowledge that the worker might leave. There's also the idea that, well, you're constrained to some degree by competitive wages, but you're also constrained by the standard practices of the profession in question or of the industry in question. And if you violate those, there may be consequences in terms of exit. So there could be, non-price norms within, particular workplaces, for instance. The idea that even if it's not contractually specified that you should, or if it's not legally specified, you should try to give workers a certain amount of time for a lunch break, let's say, without specifying if they take it in some kind of uncomfortable place. Even if that's not part of the contract, even if that's not enforced by a government regulator, it may be a norm in the industry, deviation from which may lead to costs for the deviator. So I think your point about norms is really well taken. Norms can play an extremely important role. But again, I would ask, what is the context within legal context, especially, or policy context within which those norms emerge and are ultimately enforced in either formal or informal ways?
Yeah, and I can certainly see how the threat of exit can motivate individuals to act on certain norms. I can also see, to just take a contemporary example, this example about Google recently firing someone who objected to the diversity policy.
Right.
So there's increasingly a kind of moral commitment to some of these diversity issues that are being embraced by companies. And you say, so why are they doing that? I mean, it might be because they have read some social science literature and realized that, diversity actually leads to a more well-balanced and happier work environment. But more likely it's because that they could suffer the penalties from failing to, when a newspaper publishes an article about how what the gender pay disparity or gender disparity is among engineers in Google. There's a cost to that, either from the workers themselves that may threaten to exit, or the customers, you may say, that threaten to exit. So I can see how that threat to exit can inform or support these moral norms. So that's helpful.
Yeah, I think, and maybe another example of that, which I talk about in the book, is Claudia Golden's work on on labor markets and on gender equality within labor markets. You see a whole set of professions, the veterinary profession, pharmacy or pharmacists. In those areas, what you've seen over time is increasing flexibility in the work environment, and also a sort of move towards more linearity in wages. The idea that you don't make low wages until you go full time, and then suddenly the per hour wage jumps dramatically, but rather that you're paid roughly the same per hour no matter how many hours you work. I mean, these fields, because more and more women have gone into them and have demanded the flexibility come with a better work environment, those professions, those industries have had to adjust. And had they not adjusted, and had particular businesses not adjusted by making work conditions more flexible, by moving away from this kind of non-linearity in wages and emphasis on full-time work, had they not moved away, they would have lost talented women to other businesses. And so here's another example of how certain kinds of norms, in this case, norms about flexibility of workplace environments and pay, how these things can emerge in contexts where resourced exit forces the hand of those who would otherwise perhaps exercise their arbitrary power, arbitrary economic power, in self-interested ways.
Yeah, that's great. So the bulk of the book, chapters 2, 3, and 4, take up three different spheres of society. So, and we've been talking about in large part, but maybe we could just focus briefly on each. So talk about the family in chapter 2, the market in chapter 3, and the state in chapter 4, and make a case that exit is the better option than voice in all these three different spheres. Not to say that voice is irrelevant, but that exit is a better approach. So chapter 2 on the family, there are clear forms of arbitrary power that have existed for a long time in the family, continue to exist, particularly over women, leads to exploitation. I don't know if anything you want to add to what you've already said about how it is that a resourced exit, or what would resourced exit look like in a family, and how would that address the arbitrary power that exists?
Yeah, Jeff. So the kind of arbitrary power I have in mind is the arbitrary powers described by John Stuart Mill in The Subjection of Women, the kind of patriarchal power and abuse of women that's occurred historically. It was especially bad in periods where women didn't have, in the past, when women didn't have job opportunities, when the legal system was stacked against them such that if they got a divorce, in the rare cases when they could get a divorce, they wouldn't even necessarily have a claim to their own children. I mean, under these circumstances, women are in a position absolutely to be dominated. And the question is, how can exit improve this situation, actually put constraints on dominating husbands? Well, the first and most obvious way, and the way that's been endorsed by many Republicans from Milton to Philip Pettit, is no-fault divorce, or the ability of women to at least leave or have a legal right to depart a relationship that's not going well for them, that involves abuse and exploitation. But as I point out in the book, this is hardly adequate, and I think the reasons for it are fairly straightforward. If you have no-fault divorce that's symmetric between wives and husbands, I mean, if in situations where women are vulnerable and they don't have job opportunities, or they may find themselves to be in an economically precarious situation post-divorce, men themselves can use the threat of divorce as leverage against their wives. And so it's not enough merely to secure a formal right of exit. We have to secure a substantive right of exit. We have to resource exit for women from abusive relationships. What might that look like? Well, the kinds of things I discuss in the text involve things like the provision of shelters for women who are being physically abused, vouchers in order to, for women to obtain job training so that they will actually have some kind of fallback position or occupational position in order to secure their financial setting. And finally, something along the lines of a basic income, be it a conditional or an unconditional basic income, so that they're able to leave the family and have something to fall back on, even if it's the case they haven't had the relevant kind of retraining. I think all these are examples of the way that resourcing can place women in a position to actually have voice again within marriages and have voice for the reason I talk about in the text. As long as you have a credible threat of exit, those who are engaged in abuse are going to be forced to take into account the preferences of the person they're dominating.
Yeah, that's good. I think I have a similar question to what I raised before, but let me ask this in the context of marriage markets, dating markets, and so forth. One thing I think we learn by looking at contemporary America is that there's a real class difference that has emerged between, say, the higher, you know, upper income, higher middle class. Marriages tend to be very stable and very egalitarian. I think you note this in the chapter. But at the same time, on the other side, among the lower middle class families, it's very unstable, right? So we see very unstable marriages. We see, in fact, no marriages at all. There's historic highs of children being born to single parents, especially to single women. Men spending a lot of time playing video games. So one of the questions I had with this is, so if we resource exit more, won't that be a problem for the lower class that already has a tough time maintaining the integrity of the of marriage? I mean, this is just this again, the atomism point that's just applied to the family, right? That is that isn't beefing up exit going to further erode the bonds among the lower class?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a real worry. I mean, let me first start just by talking about the way I think the situation has, to some extent, worked out among middle class and upper middle class families. In cases where women actually have a lot of educational opportunities and occupational opportunities, and what I talk about in the chapter is the fact that in those socioeconomic groups, we've seen the creation of a much more egalitarian family structure, a more egalitarian relationship between men and women within those relationships. It's certainly not perfectly egalitarian. There are sort of a residue of patriarchal marriage structures even in those relationships, for instance, in the way that domestic labor is divided up. But that being the case, I think from an historical and comparative point of view, I think these marriages are extraordinarily egalitarian. And I suppose the thought is, in terms of, you know, resourcing exit, even, you know, and especially actually for women who are poor or who are working class, the hope is that by giving them the kind of bargaining power they would therefore have within the family, it puts them in a position to demand changes to the marital culture in the poor and in the working class. So I guess the hope is, or the hope that what I hope for in providing this kind of universal resourcing is that these kinds of egalitarian marital norms that we're seeing evolve, let's say among the haute bourgeoisie, will eventually filter their way down into lower classes. And so this is the kind of diffusion process that you see described, let's say, in Gregory Clark's work, like Farewell to Alms, or say in Elias's Court Society. Now, what's been, I think, frustrating is if you examine the evidence, it looks like this process has been stymied in a number of ways. Certainly among the working class, but I would also suggest in other kinds of cultural or national contexts. So, I mean, consider the case of Japan, where women are, again, have the kinds of educational, occupational opportunities they did not have in the past. And so you would think as a result of that, you would see changes in marital culture. But in fact, those changes have been very slow. And the consequence of that is that once women obtain education, once they have occupational opportunities, and they realize that when they enter into a marriage, all the patriarchal assumptions in the past are going to hold true again, they remain single. And you have the sort of what the Japanese call parasite singles, young singles, especially young women, who continue to live at home, hold down good jobs, college educated, and spend their money on consumer goods. And they're criticized for it, but the explanation is the culture has an internal marital culture has not adapted in a way to become more egalitarian. And I have to say, this strikes me as a possible problem with the exit model, at least in some circumstances, is I guess it assumes, or I've assumed, that there's a certain amount of flexibility in norms, that norms, you might say, will evolve or evolve at least reasonably quickly in response to changes in the bargaining power of the participants. But in some cases, it seems that these norms are rather sticky. And when they're sticky, it can lead to problems. It can lead to the kinds of problems that you've described at various points in your questions as atomism, people not entering into marital relationships precisely because those relationships are not egalitarian and they feel they would be better off remaining single.
Yeah, so let's shift over to the market in chapter 3. You discuss the market and argue Republican theorists should be much more friendly to markets. You use an analogy between market competition and political competition in a constitutional system of checks and balances, which is really interesting. So how does exit in the market help address arbitrary power in the market? I'm thinking in particular because those I'm sure who will be skeptical of your view will imagine, again, someone, unskilled workers in the lower class, someone who works at Walmart. How will resourcing exit from Walmart help address the arbitrary power of Walmart?
Yeah, I think it's precisely in these cases that resourcing is in some sense most useful. Although again, I think we have to describe the various kinds of resources that are going to be placed in the hands of disadvantaged workers. So first, let's assume that the situation you're describing is the kind of troubling situation or context that I talk about in Chapter 3, namely situations where there's some kind of monopsony or oligopsony power in a labor market. Let's say the Walmart in question is in a small town. It's put all the other retailers out of business, so there's really only one place to work if you want to do retail work, or maybe there's a small competitive fringe, but really Walmart is in the driver's seat in this kind of market. Well, under those circumstances, the worry is that that Walmart or the owners or the managers may be in a position to exercise arbitrary power over workers who don't have real options. So certainly at-will employment, again, sort of formal rights of exit are essential, but what's really essential in this case is substantive resourcing of exit. And one of the most important things, and something that we don't often think about, is making workers aware of alternative employment opportunities, not necessarily in the town where they live, but in other towns, right? One of the biggest frictions in labor markets is poor information. And I think one of the things that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Labor Department more generally ought to be doing is trying to figure out how best to present information about other locations in the country to workers so they could know where job markets are the tightest, that is, in some sense, the most favorable to workers, and make plans to move there with the help of resourcing from the state, such as relocation vouchers, which we already have for workers who have been displaced by foreign competition. I don't see why that can't be expanded more. If you look at the work of Enrico Moretti, The New Geography of Jobs, I mean, what he points out is the country is becoming economically segregated in a certain kind of way, namely geographically. There are all these innovation centers around the country, the Bay Area, Austin, Texas, Washington, D.C., the Triangle in North Carolina, and other places where the economies are doing quite well, unemployment rates are low, public services in general are pretty good, including the schools. And these would be advantageous places for people to move for a variety of reasons, but including in search of work. But they often don't realize what the unemployment rates in these areas look like or what pay looks like. So providing people with information, I think, will help them realize they have opportunities to exit bad situations they're in and enter into situations that are much better. I also want to point out on the competition side that when you have situations of monopsony and oligopsony, it behooves the government to take antitrust action in these cases to try to stop this exercise of arbitrary power. You see it in a variety of contexts, for instance, recently in the Silicon Valley over the last couple of years, I guess, there have been ongoing lawsuit regarding sort of efforts by Google, by Intel and other companies to essentially agree not to hire each other's software engineers. Of course, this so-called gentleman's agreement is a form of collusion to keep down wages, and they are properly being hit with enormous damages as a consequence. The government needs to become much more aggressive about maintaining competitive conditions in labor markets, in addition to resourcing exit for poor workers.
Yeah, and you think that, or you argue that the exit is a better option for Republicans than either regulation or participation in business. These are the political options that are more familiar to Republican, general, liberal, progressive, egalitarian theorists. Either government regulating the internal structure of business or by creating more democratic practice within businesses by creating, work councils, having labor voice on the board of directors in a corporation or some such thing. When thinking about those different options, either regulation or participatory approaches, do you like either one of them better than the other, or, how would you rank them? I should ask.
Yeah, so first let me just offer some, criticisms of these alternative voice-oriented approaches within labor markets in particular. But then at the end I'll come to some exceptions, and I think the exceptions are important as well. I think in general the danger of these voice-oriented approaches, whether it's the government intervening within the internal structure of a firm or within labor markets to regulate conditions or regulate wages, or whether it's some kind of participatory approach where workers, for instance, participate in labor councils and co-manage firms, or even something like associational socialism. The problem with these kinds of approaches has to do with the fact that it's an attempt to address the problem of private power and private power held by employers. But the response is essentially to counter that either with public power in the form of the state, or some kind of countervailing private power through the organization of workers into unions or labor councils or what have you, sort of fighting fire with fire. But it's unclear in these situations whether in the end it may just be the case that one kind of power is simply replaced by another kind of power. In other words, total domination can, in principle, actually increase in these circumstances. I mean, after all, a state that's actually powerful enough to engage in the kind of minute regulation that would be necessary to counter domination on the part of employers, that is private domination, may simply lead to a form of public domination, domination not just of employers, but of employees by an almighty state. And even in cases where that's not the case, I mean, even in cases where the public domination that occurs, or let's say the private domination by unions that occurs, is less than the private domination by employers that is eliminated in the process, such that total domination actually is reduced. The fact is, it's not reduced as much as it could be through a process that emphasizes exit, because the process of emphasizing exit doesn't in the process, or tends to do this less, to create some kind of power to counter the private power. Rather, it simply eliminates or constrains the private power by improving competition and by giving people the power, the substantive ability to leave those abusive relationships, those dominating relationships. Now, having said that, that's sort of a general objection that I have to sort of voice-oriented approaches. I have to acknowledge that in some cases, exit-oriented approaches are unlikely to work. I mean, the most obvious example would be, you know, with illegal immigrants, let's say in Southern California, working on farms, picking crops. I mean, in those cases, they're extremely vulnerable. They're very unlikely to try to sign up for government benefits when doing so would make them vulnerable to deportation. They're unlikely to be able to take some kind of action or complaints, lodge complaints if there seems to be collusive behavior among farm owners, as there's evidence that there is. And so in those cases, I think an exit-oriented approach may be a very difficult one to take. And maybe something, you know, a sort of second best solution like the United Farm Workers Union, may be the best that we can do. Now, I think the first best solution in these cases is to legalize those workers, to have a much more open border policy, or at least to have a much more generous guest worker policy where the rights of these workers can be protected and their exit from abusive employment relationships can be properly resourced. But in this political climate, that doesn't seem particularly likely. So I think we always have to remain open in particular cases to using force-oriented approaches. Having said that, I think in labor markets in general, we are better off, again, usually better off, employing an exit-oriented approach.
So let's talk about the fourth chapter on the state. This was a very interesting chapter because you discuss the distinction between national government and local governments. We've already mentioned this a little bit. In the case of national government, it's difficult to imagine how a resourced exit from national governments would work and how that could be plausible. But the idea of local exit seems much more plausible, that we can resource exit through relocation vouchers that you mentioned and other things, to allow citizens to move from locality to locality such that localities themselves can compete for their citizens, and reduce the arbitrary power here. So that's very interesting, and it sort of matches with your other examples in the book. I was wondering particularly in this context about, you have a discussion about the current lack of mobility that exists in America today, that we're sort of in a historically low state of mobility from locality to locality. Do you have a sense of why that is?
Yeah, Jeff. I mean, I think the best econometric evidence we have, let me clearly state that some of this is a bit of a mystery. That is, the decline in mobility is in part a mystery. Some of it, I think, can be explained, though. And the best explanations that we have right now are, first, aging of the population. I mean, people, as they get older, are less likely to move. Therefore, as the population gets older, mobility, you know, all else equal, is likely to become less. Another feature people may not think about is, it used to be the case, more than today, I believe, that particular cities tended to specialize in one or a few industries. And so if you participated in a particular industry, you would need to move to that city. So think about the auto industry in Detroit or something like this, right? But a lot of metropolitan areas now tend to be more occupationally and industrially heterogeneous. And so if you live in a particular area, you live in the Bay Area, for instance, there are all kinds of industries and occupations that are present such that there's less need to move from one city to another in pursuit of jobs. And so there are a couple of what you might call innocent reasons for reductions in mobility. I guess my worry or my concern are with the less innocent ones, that is the ones that seem to be a product of deliberate policy choices. And I especially think here about government policy with respect to housing, the existence of the mortgage interest deduction, rollover possibilities for capital gains in housing. I mean, housing is preferentially treated as a kind of capital resource. And as a consequence, there's massive overinvestment in housing relative to what it would be in a genuinely open and competitive capital market. And the result of this is you have way more people buying homes than would otherwise buy them. And given the nature of these subsidies and the nature of housing markets, people often get locked in. If housing prices collapse, they stay put. Even though these are precisely situations where they perhaps ought to be moving in search of work, but instead they stick locally. And the consequence is that labor markets are far less fluid than they would otherwise be. And as a consequence, mobility is reduced. This is a policy choice that's being made. I think there are all kinds of reasons to stop this kind of preferential treatment of housing capital. Again, for on efficiency grounds alone, I think there's a strong case to be made for it. But certainly one of the other cases to be made for it is through its reduction of mobility, it not only reduces the efficiency of labor markets, but it keeps people who are especially vulnerable trapped in the locations that they are in many circumstances. And that's not good, I think, on equity grounds and on distributive justice grounds.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it makes me think a little bit of Tocqueville, of all people, although I've sort of been, in thinking about your book, I've been sort of fixated on this atomism problem. So I guess this is no surprise. But I mean, one might worry that, you know, mobility might be low because we live in a regime that's extremely destabilizing in our lives, and we desire a certain kind of stability. And that something like home ownership and maintaining one's place in the world is actually something that's good and desirable. It's sort of psychologically beneficial, right, to establish one's roots in a particular place, and that to encourage exit might come at the expense of that. I'm asking you the same question over and over again, Bob.
Yeah, but I think it's a great question and an important question. To reiterate something I said earlier before I give a different kind of answer, again, it may very well be the case that even when you have thoroughgoing competition in various kinds of markets and exit is resourced, that exit may very well be off the equilibrium path. I mean, that is, once everybody realizes what the new power distribution looks like under this kind of Republican resourcing policy, then it may very well be the case that potential dominators stay their hand. And as a result, people who would otherwise wish to use these resources to exit will no longer have to exit. So it's at least conceivable that if we pursue this exit-oriented strategy that I argue for in the book, that the consequence of it, maybe somewhat paradoxically, is that there may be relatively little or even potentially no increase in actual exit that goes on. Now, I think that's unlikely, but I think it's easy also to overestimate the amount of mobility and exiting that may go on, and therefore the amount of atomism or worries about atomism that may result. I mean, having said that, I think it's certainly the case that when you have insofar as, say, an exit-oriented strategy would lead to increased mobility and increased exit from relationships, just because you're leaving one kind of relationship, especially what you might call local relationships or associations, doesn't mean that there may not be some kind of continuity in other kinds of associations. So I'll just give a very parochial example, the example of academia. You know, if you're a research academic, as we are, and you think about, moving to a new university, certainly you'll be leaving behind a whole set of relationships that you've developed in your current department and having to reestablish them in another one. But does that mean you're leaving all associations? No. There are sorts of associations, the larger association of political theorists, and groups like the APT or foundations, what have you, that you continue to be part of even as you move from place to place. And I think the existence of things like social networks, just the internet itself, make it easier for people to maintain these sort of larger scale or overarching kinds of associational relationships. I don't want to suggest those are necessarily, full substitutes for more local forms of association. Nonetheless, I think it's a way anyway of limiting the degree of potential atomization that might occur.
Yeah, it's certainly one does not want to romanticize community in general, because of course, community, as you say, I mean, this is the point of exit, as community, as it say, can be extremely oppressive, and some communities need to be escaped. So one other worry, and this is a worry that you raise in the context of, I mean, Hirschman already saw this problem with exit. I want to see what how you address this problem, which is the problem that when you encourage exit, or when you provide the opportunity for exit, the people who end up taking advantage of exit are those who are well off, the ones who are already well resourced, and they leave behind poor and underprivileged. This is, there are many examples of this, from white flight to from suburbs, and de facto segregation as whites leave inner city schools. How do you address this? I mean, in part, the approach is to say, look, we're going to resource the exit of those underprivileged, and so they themselves can leave. The one question one might have is, who is there anybody left at all when you encourage everyone to exit from an underperforming school? What's your view on that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. So to give like a summary answer, I would say, yes, my position is we need to have resourced abandonment of certain kinds of schools, especially underperforming schools. Or I would go so far as to say, controversial as this is, maybe we need resourced abandonment of entire communities. But let me first sort of set up a bit more of the theoretical framework, right? So, when we're thinking about Hirschman's position, one can distinguish between sort of three types of worlds, right? There could be a no-exit world, and that's a world where everybody, the advantage, the disadvantage, is trapped together in a particular kind of environment, including underperforming institutional environments. Then you can imagine what you might call a partial exit world. In the partial exit world, the most advantaged are in fact able to leave, but that leaves the less advantaged behind, because the most advantaged tend to have a greater voice and a greater ability to affect change. It may actually make the least advantaged worse off than they would be in a no-exit world. And as you suggest, one of the things I argue in the text is we therefore need to move to a third kind of world, what I call the free-exit world. And in the free-exit world, you resource the least advantaged and improve competition in such a way that they themselves can exercise a right of exit and find a more comfortable, more supporting, and less dominating institutional environment in which to work, in which to live. So now with that as framework, I would say this is, and by the way, this is a conversation I've had with Richard Dagger over time, sort of a more communitarian Republican, is this worry that, again, it's sort of a worry over atomism, worry over the destruction of community. Maybe instead, if we're in a partial exit world, and I think in most of these cases, by the way, we are in a partial exit world, where there comes to schools, already well-heeled parents can send their kids to private schools, they can send their kids move and go to a better public school. It's the poor and the working class that doesn't have those kinds of options, at least in the current environment, and ditto with living environments, right? In certain cities, if cities are underperforming in various kinds of ways, again, the affluent can leave. Those who are not affluent are generally unable to. Could we return in some way to a no-exit world? And there I'm very skeptical. I think in some sense, the horse is out of the barn. I mean, consider set aside the school examples, just think about certain areas of the country, for instance, sort of disadvantaged areas of the country. Think about inner cities. Think about Appalachia. Think about the Mississippi Delta. I mean, these cases, in some sense, the most advantaged, the most educated, the most entrepreneurial have already left. And those who are left have certainly been injured by their departure, but it's unclear, sort of consistent with basic liberties, how those people can be brought back, right? They've gone and they're not returning, and these communities are suffering as a consequence. And therefore, I think really the only alternative we have, there is no going from a partial exit world back to a no exit world. Whether that's putting the horse back in the barn or the genie back in the bottle. Instead, all you can do is double down on exit. You can try to give the same kinds of substantive mobility rights to those who are poor and working class, to those who are disadvantaged. And the consequence of this, as you say, may be the resourced abandonment of schools, of underperforming schools. If schools are bad and everybody has a chance to exit, and everybody does exit, then that school goes bankrupt. It goes under. And ditto for communities. Again, this is kind of like a community triage, I suppose. But I think in many of these cases, in many of these small towns in Appalachia or the Mississippi Delta, it may simply be the best approach to do a resourced abandonment of the communities in question to get people moved to the innovation centers in the country where there are more jobs. And of course, in those centers, there are all kinds of policy innovations that need to take place in order that those areas be able to absorb these newcomers, right? Whether it's through modifications of zoning law so you can have higher density residential complexes and get rents down, expansion of public transportation networks and so forth. We need to have greater density and more affordable housing in these areas where the jobs exist. But I think trying to recreate communities as they once existed in the past, sort of return to a kind of no exit strategy of hunkering down and improving things where you are, is not going to ultimately work in this case.
So last question. Have you talked to Pettit and Lovett? I know you've talked to Dagger about your views. Are they convinced at all?
Yeah, I think you can sort of divide the Republican world really, you know, crudely into what you might call, you know, liberal Republicans like Pettit and Lovett, to critical Republicans like Cecile Laborde and others, and then maybe more radical Republicans like Gurevich. I don't think my approach is particularly persuasive to people like Laborde or to Gurevich, but in talking to Pettit and to Lovett, I think they're quite sympathetic to my approach. And they find it congenial. That's not to say that they agree with me completely. Rather, I think liberal Republicans are in a position where they're already fairly open to the use of markets. And they don't see markets as being necessarily inconsistent with freedom as non-domination. In fact, they see it following the footsteps of people like Adam Smith. They see it at least potentially as a tool to realize non-dominating relationships. I think where there may be some differences between, I say, myself and Lovett and Pettit and other kinds of liberal Republicans is sort of the degree of emphasis that I put on competitive markets, on resourced exit. And I probably go further in this way than they would be comfortable with. And I think that's as a consequence not of differences in our theoretical commitments, but rather differences in terms of what we take to be the institutional implications of republicanism. What does it imply in terms of policies, of laws, of constitutional structures? And I think it's the case that markets, competition, and this resourcing of exit can be more effective, in fact, substantially more effective, even than I think most liberal Republicans like Pettit and Lovett think it can be across these three spheres of family, market, and state. And so I'm fairly optimistic about the use of these. Now, obviously, this is going to require a great deal of institutional reform. It's not enough simply to say, let markets rip. It has to be the case that the state takes an active role in making those markets, be they spousal markets, residential markets, labor markets, what have you, more competitive, and genuinely providing the least advantage with the resources necessary to leave abusive relationships that are embedded within those markets. And so I think there's cause for, there's reason for some degree of skepticism, but I think those concerns can be overcome with the proper kinds of reforms.
Yeah, well, I look forward to reading their reviews in the top journals out there. Congratulations on the book, Bob, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks again for all of this. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with it. And thanks so much to Kasia Hinkson for producing and editing the show. And thanks to you for listening.